Have you ever felt the weight of limited resources holding back your startup's potential? You are not alone. Many entrepreneurs and investors grapple with the challenge of accessing expensive equipment, often starting groundbreaking research and development.
And I was like the light bulb went off. I was like, the building and solving the problem solving element from like my previous history in gaming really was like, okay, here's a problem. That's when the rubber met the road. It's, you know, the entrepreneurship like journey started, because I wanted to alleviate that burden and that obstacle that was impeding, you know, our lab's ability to do research.
Silicon Valley, the heart of innovation, is no stranger to these challenges. But what if there was a way to bypass these hurdles, to leapfrog the traditional barriers and accelerate your startup's journey? Enter John Che, CEO and co-founder of Exceder. With a rich background in molecular toxicology and over a decade in the life science industry, John's vision is reshaping the biotech startup landscape. Exceder's revolutionary leasing model is a beacon of hope for startups, offering an alternative to hefty equipment costs and propelling research at an unprecedented pace. In today's episode, we'll dive deep into the innovative intersection of life science and financial services, the transformative impact of Exceder's leasing model on biotech startups, John's personal journey, and the lessons he's gleaned from Silicon Valley's vibrant ecosystem. If you find value in this episode, please like, comment, and share. Your support helps the team bring more industry leaders like John Che to share invaluable insights. Are you ready to uncover the secrets of thriving in the biotech world? Then watch the full episode now.
Yeah,
like Joe Rogan, Lex Friedman, they just chat.
Yeah, yeah. That's exactly that. That's my vibe too.
How do you do it with your podcast?
Same, very much the same. For our podcast, I don't know. I only know how to do it kind of like my style. And I guess the only way I can really describe it is like a conversation you'd have with a friend over a beer. Mm-hmm. Like it's, you know, it's just, it's very casual. And you know, there's definitely like, you know, we get into the meat of things, but, mm-hmm. it's definitely very casual. So that, yeah. And long form. So mm-hmm. It's just easier that way.
Yes, I saw you on your website that you dissect each episode into three parts or two parts.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Yeah. And I think that was, you know, I realize that we may be in the rare few who couldn't listen to a podcast, you know, for more than 30 minutes. So I wanted to save everyone. I didn't want to hold people hostage. So it's like, okay, how can we create kind of like more digestible chunks mm-hmm. where people, you know, maybe in their commute, at the gym, washing the dishes, or, you know, doing laundry, can listen and, you know, not feel like they need to find a place to sit for, mm-hmm. for like a couple hours at a time.
Yeah. But the 30 minutes chunks is a good idea.
Yeah. I mean, so far so good. I think, you know, it's kind of an experiment that we're running. You know, there's certainly, you know, certainly, kind of benefits to be going long as well. And I definitely, you know, the table of contents and kind of the timestamps certainly help, you know, just kind of if people are not really interested in this, just like, you know, just like jump ahead. And, you know, sometimes I do that too. So, you know, I think there's pros and cons about.
So my search mode is when I see a new episode that catches my attention. Usually it's the picture and it's the speaker in the headline. Then I look in the table of contents and I test first what the parts I like the most or the parts that resonate the most with me. And when I look at the first one or two chunks or listen to the first one or two chunks, then I decide to go the whole length or just to switch to the next one. When there are no timestamps, it always looks to me like it's like this black box. I mean, what's in there?
Yeah. That's actually a great, I haven't like approached it that way. That sounds like a great discovery mechanism. I'll just like start a podcast and just like, boop, skip 30. Okay. Oh, okay. I like where this is going. And then and just keep going. That's a great tip. Cause I, you know, there's so many good podcasts out there on all topics really. And you know, it definitely, it can become unwieldy to try and sort through all of it and figure out there's only so many hours in the day. You're like, I need to like figure out which ones I'm going to actually listen to. But I like that strategy a lot.
You mentioned before you treat podcasting like having a conversation with a good friend over a beer. Yep. So this, I think it's, this is the question in my mind. Do you have a beer now? On the table.
start the day, baby. Just like out of the gates, just starting the day right. I mean, it's almost Friday, so if this was Friday, maybe we'd it'd be a different story. But you know, that's definitely the energy we try to channel on the podcast.
I mean, I'm in Central Europe, so close to Germany, and some people say, especially in Bavaria, that beer actually is no alcohol, so you can drink it the whole day.
That's deaf science. Science that is, beer is not alcohol, it is the water.
It's water, it tastes good. Let's talk about entrepreneurship a little bit. You're in Silicon Valley in San Francisco, and you decided to become an entrepreneur. Why?
Yeah, that's really a great question. And I was, sitting down for dinner with my wife and kind of reflecting a little bit. And I think a lot of it, and honestly, growing up, so I grew up in an immigrant household, and my parents actually deemed entrepreneurship too risky because they left their home countries and they were seeking stability. Mm-hmm. So when I, broke it to them that I was interested in entrepreneurship, it really freaked them out. You can imagine. And so my father was a structural engineer and my mother was in finance, and both worked at their respective firms for 40 plus years until they retired. Wow. Same firm.
40 years, same firm.
Same firm.
That's impressive. Yep.
Stability, right? Stability. And I think, my parents definitely had a different view on entrepreneurship, but I think I've always liked to build things. That has been a consistent theme growing up. And, an example would be my interest in games, whether it be board games, computer games like StarCraft or RPGs. Mm-hmm. Those kind of like the element of building has always fascinated me. And I always thought that building, in a game had a lot of kind of similarities to company building. Way lower stakes, way lower stakes, but you get way higher kind of velocity and repetition and iteration in one given game. So, things like, managing resources and under time constraints, competing against your opponents, multivariable analysis, strategy, tactics, scenario planning. And so I think that was really the start of like my kind of like entrepreneurship kind of building itch. And even though, I probably at the time when I was a kid, I wouldn't call that entrepreneurship. It would just be gaming. And it wasn't until I got to UC Berkeley that I kind of found a kind of a commercial outlet for this itch. And that was the life sciences and wet lab research. And that was when the magic happened. And I think, you know, entrepreneurship for me and company building was really about kind of like to serve the community that I, like my people. And I really started to, you know, feel like part of the scientific community, and I wanted to continue to build within it. And I, you know, and I'll just give you a couple stories here about kind of like what, you know, what really, you know, basically got to the founding of Exceder and really kicked off the entrepreneurship kind of stint. So when I've been in labs that are well-funded and also not so well-funded, I've seen both. And, you know, it opened my eyes a lot. Like, you know, not every single lab can be well-funded. I wish it was the case, right? But capital and time are finite resources. So when I was doing a stint in a kind of a lab that wasn't as well-funded, you know, we had, it was at the bottom of the hill at UC Berkeley. And then there's a very steep hill that get where the core facility, where the flow cytometer was at. So my days would, I would be running samples up and down this hill all day, every day. And I really was like, there's got to be a better way to do research than having to run samples up and down a hill. And I was, so I, you know, I went back to my colleagues in the lab and I was like, can we get a cell sorter in the lab? And, you know, at that time I was like wide-eyed, you know, bushy-tailed. And I was like, you know, I didn't know how much these things cost. And, you know, the PI was like, you know, that's $500,000, right? And I was like, oh, that's why we don't have it in the lab. That's why we don't have it in the lab. And so that really, that was when I was like the light bulb went off. I was like, the building and solving the problem solving element from like my previous history in gaming really was like, okay, here's a problem that I think is very problematic for research. And also to add too, I was, you know, the PI also mentioned that if this thing breaks down, it's like the repairs are also equally expensive. He basically described it like a Ferrari in a lab. It's like, if you don't tune it and if you don't maintain it, it's going to break and it costs an arm and a leg to fix. So that's when the rubber met the road. It's, you know, the entrepreneurship like journey started because I wanted to alleviate that burden and that obstacle that was impeding, you know, our lab's ability to do research. And I, you know, obviously I spoke to other labs as well. And I said, is this something that you are experiencing too? And they said, yes. The well-funded ones, not so much. They're like, got three of them. But yeah, so that's where it got her start.
But it even makes sense for the well-funded ones. They have more capital than to allocate to other things, to studies, for example. Before we dive into your company and your entrepreneurship story deeper, there is one word that you mentioned that made me curious and I want to know more about it. A little bit of a side story at the beginning.
Yeah.
You said you love playing games.
Yep.
So my question is, what are your three favorite games?
Okay. So StarCraft is up there. And this is games broadly speaking. Okay. StarCraft, Settlers of Catan.
Settlers of Catan.
But Settlers of Catan.
This is an over the board game, isn't it?
Yeah, that's a board game. So growing up, our friends and family would play board games.
Yeah.
That was a thing that we would do. So they got started early. And then also Zelda was another game that I continue to love to this day. You know, Zelda had an element of like But we're still friends, but it's gotten heated sometimes.
But only outside the game. So during the game, you're enemies, basically.
Yes.
Competitors.
Yes, exactly. And then, you know, after that, we break bread.
Yeah. What about, yeah. I heard in other podcasts that in San Francisco, especially billionaire investors love poker. Is this also one of your passions?
So, I can't say I'm the best. I'm decent. But my friends all are, they tend to like study game theory, you know, and are, you know, very much like they're kind of like, how would I say, they're very optimal in how they play poker. You know, this is the perfect size of the pot. I should, you know, raise the pot this much, whatever, like, you know, they kind of do a decision tree.
Yeah.
And are very much optimal. And that's one way to play the game. But I would say my style of poker is I'm not as good at optimizing as they are, but I know when to be like kind of a wild card and just like, because, you know, game theory assumes that everyone is participating in game theory, but sometimes I'll just go in and just disrupt it. Yeah, and it pisses them off to no end. They're like, why would you do that? That's so irrational. I'm like, that's the point.
That's human, point. Yeah.
Yeah, that's the point. Like, so yes, very much poker is a popular game amongst the... And it has a lot of similarities to investing, right? It's like, when do you go in and when do you fold? And how hard do you go in? So I think there's a lot of similarities as well, when you think about the games, comparatively speaking, to investing.
Yeah, it's interesting. I think the first podcast I heard about poker in Silicon Valley was Lex Fridman. He invited the world champion of poker. And until this, I don't play poker. So I played it sometimes in my youth against computers when it was the 90s, when the first poker games went online. And it was just for fun. And you always treated it like a fun game. You just bet and sometimes you bluff, sometimes you don't. And at the end of the day, you lose some and you win some. But I never thought there is a science behind it. And then this world champion, similar to you, started explaining the game theory behind poker. And I loved game theory when I was at the university, when I studied economics. I have still a book here. So The Art of Strategy.
Yeah.
But I never connected it in my mind to poker, to playing poker. And he went deep into that. And after that, Lex Fridman had a podcast with the world champion in playing chess. And he also explained that in chess, there's a lot of game theory in it. So sometimes, as you said, sometimes you just disrupt the opening with an irrational move to throw off the opponent. Do you like game theory?
Stay with us. We'll be right back.
You love listening to podcasts, but have you ever thought about starting your own podcast? Maybe you want to build a brand, grow your business, or are looking for an excuse to talk about your favorite hobby. Whatever your reason for making a podcast, Buzzsprout is the place to start. Since 2009, Buzzsprout has helped over 300,000 people launch their own podcasts. Buzzsprout walks you step by step through the whole process and will give you powerful tools to start, grow, and monetize your podcast. Ready to get started? Click the link in the show notes to get our free step-by-step guide to starting your podcast today.
Yeah, so I do like game theory, but I think you can get almost too hung up on it. It's like that's
like an addiction. Style.
Yeah. It's like, you know, it almost is like dogma at times. People will take it as dogma. So I think it's, you know, the world is but like I think as you get into the world of like business, it becomes more and people will do things that will surprise you all the time. So it's good to know. It's like an arrow in your quiver, but shouldn't be the only one.
Yeah, it's at some point you think, I have seen it all in business and I'm not surprised. And then a new person comes to the game and I didn't expect that. You said earlier that poker is similar to venture investing.
Yep.
Can you explain it a little bit further? Why you see that? You can blame the question on me.
So the poker is similar to investing, generally speaking, is because when you see an opportunity, right? Like, and this, like, so you think about Texas Hold'em, like as the cards are being revealed, like the odds like are changing, like, and as the odds are changing, you're deciding to increase your investment by raising the pot, or and let's continue the analogy here with venture investing. It's like you can do a follow-on round, you can do an up round, or you can do a down round, right? And it's kind of like sizing up the bet, or, you know, as the circumstances are changing. What are the prospects for this business? I think we're gonna up our bet, right? Grow the percentage of our investment. And similarly, when you're doing that in poker, as the cards are being revealed, the odds are changing, and then you're doing a statistical analysis of like, okay, what are the odds of this paying out, and then you bet accordingly. But obviously, that's very, you can make optimal bets based on, you know, you can have like models just running this until someone comes in and just bluffs you, right? And right. So, but you know, sometimes that's investing too. People will do irrational things. So that's why there's some similarities to it.
Yeah. Then it works.
For and personalities like is very important. Like, you know, business is it's a relationship game, and it's a person, like, it's all about people knowing your personnel. So poker, that way everyone has their own style, you know, and getting a read on people is important. And knowing, you know, the incentives and the mindset of the counterparty or your opponent on at the poker table is also very important. Likewise with investing.
So it's a lot different playing with new people than with people that you know for a few decades.
Yeah.
Probably.
Yeah. And you know, you kind of can get a read on the people you've been playing with for a long time. And then someone new comes in and you're just like, okay, I have zero data on this person. We're going to see how this unfolds.
The Europeans that come to Silicon Valley for raising funds and relocating.
It's like, you know, there is definitely similarities, which is why I think, you know, gaming, generally speaking, as much as it was, you know, early days, like, this is a bad habit or like, but I don't, like, I have a ton of life lessons that, you know, I take away from.
I grew up in the 80s and Austria. Rural area, mountains, basically simple people most of the time, even in school, and very focused on getting your daily business done. It was just basically the 80s, pre-internet times, completely different. And this was the time when the first gaming computers hit the market. And the general perception in society about gaming was very negative. So teachers told my parents, your son loves gaming. He will become a loner and he will sit in front of the computer completely alone his entire life.
Yeah.
You have to prohibit that. Gaming is evil and gaming is bad.
Yeah.
And it was later, I think it was 10 years or 15 years later, when the first scientific studies came out and said, no, actually, they teach a lot of good lessons to kids. Yeah. The right games, simulations, for example. Like what was in the 90s, Civilization. So these building games, it's like Settlers of Catan is similar, but just on a computer. How do you see gaming these days?
I think there's a lot of great games out there, but the internet has really opened up the aperture of like what type of games, you know, the the early days of like PC gaming, like StarCraft and stuff, you know, now the versions of that, like Dota and everything, which are like that on steroids. So it's like, you know, I think there are definitely a lot of lessons still to be learned from gaming. Albeit I don't play as much as I used to. So I don't have a professional opinion. That's a great question. So I was actually born and raised in Berkeley, and all of my education in Berkeley too. So I haven't really gone that far. Now being in San Francisco, I'm maybe like 10 miles away from where I was born. So the city of Berkeley, California is, I would say, very unique. Has a unique vibe and culture, which is like, has left, like it's seared into my DNA. You know, Berkeley is known for like the hippie movement, counterculture, has cooperatives and communes. My favorite pizza place, Cheeseboard, is a co-op. You know, but and everyone's very autonomous. You do your own thing. Yet, you know, there's like there's a little bit of a duet, like a kind of a paradox to that. It's autonomous, but cooperative.
Is it still a hippie place?
It has changed. There's the demographics have changed from when I was growing up. But the roots of the city of Berkeley definitely still have it for sure. If you kind of start getting away from the UC Berkeley campus and like get to where it's more residential, definitely still has a hippie culture. And growing up in Berkeley, you know, I used to skateboard a lot. I used to go to punk rock shows, played games. So I had a very eclectic kind of upbringing, maybe rebellious in some ways. And this is probably why I went in the direction, like career-wise, that I did. Maybe it was an act of rebellion. I won't overly psychoanalyze it, but perhaps it was that. And, you know, that was kind of like my adolescence. And then going to Berkeley, there was like a intense like amount of rigor and like embrace of like experimentation at Berkeley. And, you know, it was very much okay to take risks and fail as long as, you know, you learn from your mistakes. But that said, it wasn't a thing where, you know, UC Berkeley was sink or swim. Like, you're taking the risk and you're going to bear the brunt of the consequences. But that's how you learn the hard way. And you'll never forget those lessons. And you get stronger the next go around. So that's kind of like the culture of UC Berkeley as an institution. And I would even say this kind of extends broadly to the Bay Area and Silicon Valley. There's a lot of experimentation and just kind of like risk taking. And, you know, now when I think about how that kind of has impacted Exceder and how that has like kind of influenced my style and our style is, you know, we continue to really embrace like rigorous experimentation. You know, anyone at the company can run their own A/B test and to see if there's a better way of doing things. I'm not beholden to any one way of doing something. If there's something that's better, let's test it out. You know, I don't think there's one right way to do anything. And another thing is like kind of like challenging the status quo. Like that culture of just like asking why do we do these things is important. And I think that's, you know, definitely part of the Berkeley upbringing. You know, leasing, Exceder does equipment leases, you know, leasing is an age-old industry, but we're still continuing to find clever ways to do it differently. And you know, there's an element of like autonomy and collaboration within Exceder, where everyone has autonomy over their domain, but continues to collaborate with each other. Kind of like what I was saying, like, you know, there's Berkeley has co-ops, but people are very much do their own thing. And so it's a kind of this weird duality, mm-hmm. but what it results in is like a lot of like 1+1=5 outcomes, which is fantastic. And then the kind of the last thing I would say is that we're always looking for positive sum or like win-win situations. So we're always looking to grow the pie rather than just trying to extract value and just split the pie. So we're always looking ways like, how can we bring value to all stakeholders here? Mm-hmm. Vendors, customers, employees, the community, every time we make a decision. So I realize that sounds very kind of chaotic and eclectic, but it's worked well for us, and, you know, and keeps everyone energized, and keeps me, you know, I'm pumped up to get to work every day.
Now, if you want to disrupt things, you have to play trial and error and try to find better ways to do things rather than continuing down the old route and complain about things not working. It's risky. Some things will fail. I mean, currently I read the biography of Tim Cook. So all big companies that I'm aware of, Apple, Amazon, Google, Alphabet, Tesla, they all have their stories of failure. But I think these are necessary to find the few things that really work then. I'm curious about your career. So you grew up in Berkeley, you studied in Berkeley, you graduated from the university.
Yep.
And then you decided to start your company, or was there a step in between that you tasted the smell of secure and safe jobs in the industry?
Yeah. So there was a very short stint where I worked at a law firm.
At a law firm?
Yeah.
How that?
Yeah. It was a science focused law firm that handled a lot of scientific work and cases. And you know, this was like before I found my love for wet lab research. I was like trying to figure it out. I was like, I knew I wanted to be in the sciences, but in what shape or form, I wasn't quite sure. At one point in time, you know, the very first, you know, and this is not novel in any way, but like when I was first getting to university, it was like, okay, maybe I'll be a doctor. That's science. Didn't want to do that. Wasn't a fit. And then I was like, okay. And maybe this is before like I went full rebellious, because like stability of like a doctor, and I was like, okay, maybe a lawyer, but I still want to be in science. So like, I'll try that out. And that was like a brief taste of stability. And it just was not my style, And, you know, to each their own, there's nothing wrong with it. But it didn't really, I didn't find as much energy as I wanted to. So after that short stint, dove right into wet lab research, and then within the lab ecosystem, kind of spun Exceder out of that experience.
And the labs were part of the university.
Yep.
Okay. Why not the academic route? I mean, your parents probably would have appreciated
it. Yeah, they would have loved it. I think the academic route was, well, I always saw it as like becoming a professor is like harder than getting into the NBA, like to play basketball.
Yeah, it's Berkeley probably.
Yeah. It's just like harder than the NBA. And, you know, when I saw the statistics of who ends up becoming professors, especially those that are tenured, I was like, there's a lot of better basketball players or like academics than me, right? Like, and so I think that's an Exceder is kind of, you know, despite us not, you know, we're playing a supportive role for those in research, whether it be academia, for profit, early stage, late stage. We're still very, very much involved with every, and, you know, obviously life science academia plays hand in hand with, you know, industry as well. A lot of the technologies derive from academia. So, you know, we're still playing our part, but, you know, when, you know, Draymond Green, Steph Curry are on the court, we'll let them do their thing. And then, you know, we'll play, we'll do ours.
Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Coaching Conversation 2024. This podcast is 100% dedicated to leadership and leadership within the workplace coaching area. We work with companies throughout the world teaching leaders how to coach their employees. This podcast is dedicated to teaching specific strategies, frameworks, coaching models, and now artificial intelligence strategies to help leaders drive greater teamwork, collaboration, cooperation, greater attitudes, better motivation, coaching career development, just to name a few. I hope you'll check out our podcast.
I'm curious now, you're in the lab and you said you had to run up and down the hill to deliver thing. And then at one point you had the idea, why not leasing? So basically you saw the problem. You had an idea about the solution. And what happened then? Because, I mean, many people see problems and then go out on the market, see a solution, leasing stuff. I mean, there are leasing companies out there already. So why did you decide then? I really want to dissect a little bit this moment of revelation that there is probably a bigger game going on or a bigger pie that you can dive into.
Yeah, I think there's a little bit, you know, it's been a, you know, or if I turn back the hands of time and think about what mind, like kind of the mind state I was in back then, I was probably a little bit naive. You know, I didn't know what I didn't know. And that might have been a benefit, honestly. If I knew all of the intricacies of this up front, maybe I would have been a professor or tried to be. Right. Maybe I would have taken a different career path. Yeah. But I think, you know, what makes us special is that we only specialize and do like scientific lab equipment. Mm-hmm. That's all we do. We know the labs really well. We know the equipment really well. We know the industry really well. It was basically, I'm selling to myself or former self. Mm-hmm. So I was like scratching my own itch. And so I knew that we could do it better than, you know, a large financial institution who simply thinks of a researcher as just a number in a spreadsheet. Mm-hmm. Frankly, that's what a, you know, JP Morgan, as much as, you know, as they, you know, as large as they are, they probably have you as a number in a spreadsheet somewhere. Yeah.
No, go ahead.
Oh, no. Yeah. I'll just say, you know, that was, you know, we thought we can do it better. We're selling to our colleagues. And two, the repair and maintenance component is a big differentiator. When something breaks down during the lease, we make sure it gets repaired and maintained for the duration of the term to make sure there's no, you know, for example, if you have a big research milestone coming up, you know, that you need to what? If you need to present at a conference, present to investors, submit, you know, to the FDA, that's a real deadline. Mm-hmm. And if your flow cytometer breaks, they don't care. Like they do not care. So absolutely. There's an element of one, you know, there's the leasing component of us being able to get equipment in the hands of researchers better than, you know, what's out there because of our intimate knowledge of it. Mm-hmm. And two, also making sure that these instruments are running at their best. So in the case you have a critical deadline coming up, you don't miss a beat, even if there was, you know, hopefully, God forbid, a breakdown. But that was the kind of, I would say back then, the kind of the key insights and, you know, working it out and just kind of like testing. There was a lot of testing on how this would be formulated. And it was until it took a while to get the product market fit. But once it was there, we're off to the races.
So your company focuses basically on biotech life science. That's correct. And geographically, it's just Silicon Valley, or do you also support scientists, researchers, and early stage companies all over the United States?
All over the United States. So that, you know, that has been, you know, we're very proud of that, that we mm-hmm. we pretty much operate in all the states. And, you know, but obviously there's concentrations around the kind of like hotbeds mm-hmm. Of kind of universities. But yeah, that is definitely, you know, kind of our focus is like serving the US community and, you know, kind of arming the rebels, like getting getting the equipment into the hands of the researchers that need it. Because I always think back on that experience, you know, of being in the lab that wasn't as well funded. It's like we were doing great research, but we just like couldn't move at the pace that we wanted to because I had to run up and down the hill. I was like slowing things down.
But it's good. It's good training. It's good for your health.
Yeah. I had great cardio. I was in fit shape. That's for sure.
So basically, your company takes on the big guys, JP Morgan, like JP Morgan, for example, and you can help other startups to take on their big guys in their industries, and help them with a speedy process to their lab equipment. You replace, you repair it. What about conquering the world? What about leaving the United States and coming to Europe and Asia?
Yeah. So, you know, I think we at Exceder, if we're going to do something, we want to do it right. Mm-hmm. We have a very high bar, like a high standard for ourselves and our product. And this is definitely something that we've looked into. And we're starting to, you know, have more formal motions into a international expansion. Mm-hmm. And I think it is. I know if I'm looking even farther out, it's definitely going to happen. But the timing of when is the question mark for us.
Yeah.
And the question of when is because we just want to be able to do it right. We don't want to roll something out half baked and have it, and, you know, have the lab have a bad experience. We want the same, you know, kind of experience, the high quality experience that those labs that work with us in the United States, we want that for every country, any country that we go into. Mm-hmm. And obviously there's a lot of also like, you know,
Europe is the right place to be. You will have a lot of fun.
Yeah. We were doing some preliminary research. I was like, oh boy. okay. One, there's a massive time difference. Two, just like, oh boy. Like there's a lot of intricacy here. it seemed that like there was just so like there's very fine nuances between every, you know, every region.
You have
so
different cultures, different yeah. languages, different legal systems, sometimes different currencies.
Yeah.
Very small countries like Austria, 9 million inhabitants. Then you have the Czech Republic, completely different language with about 10 million inhabitants. And this is just, the European game is one of the most complicated games that you can play. So this makes it interesting. But there are good ecosystems here for leasing, I suppose. Let's go back to Berkeley. I have a few questions for the ecosystem. So you founded your company, you started your first company in Berkeley, and then you served other startups and also experienced other ecosystems in the United States. What makes the area around Berkeley so special? How helpful are they for entrepreneurs?
Yeah. So my experience might be dated at this point. When I was getting started, Berkeley actually didn't really have like a formal entrepreneurship program. It was actually like it was not a popular career path at that yet. Like, you know, and this, you know, it was actually kind of frowned upon. I actually remember taking some early meetings as I was kind of like surveying the campus, mm-hmm. Where I was like getting kicked out of like professors' like offices because I had, you know, the gall of talking about Exceder and a potential business opportunity.
Really? We are talking about 2010, around this time, 2010, yep. 11, 11-ish.
Yep. Yep. Exactly.
I always thought everybody loves entrepreneurship in the United States.
Academia
has very stereotypical.
Yeah. Stanford at that time embraced it.
Okay.
Like very much embraced it. I think Berkeley was a little bit later.
But for me as an Austrian, I mean, when I look at Google Maps, it looks very close, Stanford and Berkeley. And this was such a huge cultural gap.
Yeah.
Oh, huge. I didn't know that. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, huge. You know, and I guess part of that is like, you know, the UC system, it's a public research institution. Mm-hmm. So there is probably, you know, some, you know, intricacies compared to an institution like Stanford, which is a private university. So there's like, there are definitely different cultural norms. And I'll say that, like, you know, this was a while ago, right? So things have changed, you know. Mm-hmm. Berkeley definitely now, like, and you know, 2010, that was like when Uber was just getting started and Airbnb was like just getting started, right? So like entrepreneurship hadn't yet to become like kind of like in the mainstream. And so it was kind of like that you either go into big pharma or you become a professor. That was kind of the track. So it was kind of weird when I had, you know, I definitely felt weird.
This is true, and it was still the aftermath of the financial crisis of 2007, 2008.
Yes.
Interest rates were about going down, but not yet really down.
Not yet.
Europe was almost failing financially, I remember. Yeah.
Yeah. It was a different time.
Like, that's true.
It was a very, very different time. And, you know, you fast forward to now, and Berkeley is doing a lot to embrace entrepreneurship, you know. Classes, they have their own accelerator incubator programs, training programs, mentorships, like industry collaborations, internship opportunities. Like if you want to work at a startup and get a feel of what a startup is like, Berkeley will help you. They'll place you like that. Like, you know, it's like now it's like this is a very viable track and Berkeley is investing heavily in it. But for us, you know, we're getting started. It was like me and my co-founder just like baptism of fire, just like, you know, figure it out. And like, and you know, it was really, really painful in that way. But there's so many lessons that we still carry to this day from having to go through that trial. You know, and you know, and I would say even back then the venture community wasn't as developed. You know, entrepreneurship as a concept was still kind of new for biotech. You know, a lot of the R&D was taking place in big pharma. And so, you know, for my co-founder and I, you know, we bootstrapped the thing. So when we put our life savings into Exceder, you know, it really, really forces you to think long and hard about every decision you make, right? When it's going to either make the difference of like, can I pay rent or not pay rent, right? The weight of it is very real. And that's kind of resulted in kind of this culture of like efficiency and focusing on how to be creative within these constraints within Exceder that I think, you know, benefits us to this day.
So you bootstrapped your company without the help of venture capital.
That's correct.
And you put your entire life savings back then on the line.
You can imagine my parents were not happy about that.
I can. My mother is not so,
my parents were not happy about that. You know, there are definitely some scary times. But, you know, like, I think, you know, I also don't think our business is like a venture business, right? It's, you know, we're very different in that way. But yeah, it's, you know, the kind of the bootstrapped beginnings, and we're still bootstrapped. It influences the culture a lot.
So you and your founding partner still own 100% of the company and didn't give any equity away to private equity companies or venture capitalists or on the public market to other investment firms.
Yeah, that's correct.
That's impressive. I mean, it's basically the way I learned back in the 90s and 80s how to start companies, look for customers first.
I joke about this, but it's kind of real. It's like our investors are our customers.
Yeah.
Like, right? It's like find customers who find value in what you do and are willing to pay you for it. And if the more value you bring to them, the more they're willing to pay you. I think that was, you know, obviously in the very beginning, it was finding the first customer was painstakingly hard, like so hard. I was a scientist. I didn't know how to do sales. I had maybe one like set of clothes that I thought was business appropriate, just an ill-fitting suit and like wrinkled. And just like, I would actually do like door-to-door sales. Then like I would go and like knock on doors of labs and see if I thought that's what sales was. I guess it still kind of is, but you know, those are the early days, is like really actually just like driving around the Bay Area looking for customers. But that scrappiness that I think that, you know, we still kind of embrace.
So you are the Grant Cardone and Gary Vaynerchuk of the life science industry, basically. So you've
I mean, they're you know, they're doing their thing on a much larger, grander scale. Yeah. I didn't know better, right? Mm. It's like, you know, I think I was talking about this earlier. You don't know what you don't know, and I think you don't want to get hung up, like as a founder. It can be problematic to get hung up on what has been like over researching and, you know, getting hung up on what's been done in the past and like this problem is solved. Because I think having a little bit of that ignorance or naivete can benefit you as a founder, because it makes impossible problems feel possible. And then you strive for that.
I mean, you didn't have a commercial training at Berkeley, so molecular toxicology. How did you flip the switch in your mind to go chasing customers instead of not chasing customers?
Yeah. So my co-founder actually comes from finance. So he's actually, you know, has a deep finance background. And so he kind of kicked me in the butt and said, get to it. Go start doing some sales. I'm like, what do you mean? He's like, just figure it out. And so that, I got to say, it came from him. Jeff, you know, really kicked me in the butt to do it. And, you know, and there was so many, like, sales is like a science as much as it is an art as well. So applying the kind of the rigor of wet lab research and applying it to sales, is very applicable. As much as they feel like very disparate fields, you can get very scientific with sales as well. So I think as much as, you know, I was unfamiliar with it, I just needed that kick in the butt, just like to go do it. And then, you know, just basically applied, you know, kind of the training that I had in, you know, academia and just applied it to sales. And, you know, and just kind of continued to iterate from there.
I'm curious now, you have a co-founder who he's from finance, he has a finance background. How did you bridge the gap between science and finance? Particularly here in Europe, I often experience that scientists and business people seem to have sometimes a hard time to get along well together. How did you bridge the gap in your company?
I think, you know, maybe it is the Berkeley upbringing where we're all like kind of the co-op mentality, where we're all in this together equally. You know, I like to joke that as much as Jeff kicked me in the butt to, you know, to focus on business and finance, I also imparted on him an appreciation for science, and like via osmosis, he's like an honorary biochemist now. Like it goes both ways. Yeah. And I think, you know, before being co-founders, we were longtime friends. And so we very much respect each other and our own kind of like domains and disciplines, and having that respect for each other. And I think in the sciences, you know, it can be very easy to say that the success of a scientific endeavor is purely the science, but I disagree. And you know, I might get beat up for this on the internet, but it's okay. You know,
it's more clicks. It's more clicks then. Don't worry.
Yeah. Exactly. And I think one, you know, communicating the science is very important, right? This is like reading, writing, like being able to verbalize and communicate the science is very important. That's not the science itself, right? It's like, how do you interact with people? You know, the finance aspect. It's like, how do we keep the lights on? Like if your lab doesn't, like, you know, if you can't run your lab and you can't pay the bills and, you know, PG&E or, you know, they're turning off the lights on you, the science comes to a grinding halt. So I think me and my co-founder at Exceder, we very much embrace the mentality that it takes a village to get it done, especially in the sciences, whether it's you're in marketing, operations, legal, finance, or you're in the science side and technology. Everyone comes together, and when you work together, magic happens. And I always think it's like a little miracle when something gets through the clinic, right? But it's getting through the clinic is no small feat, but it takes so many people and so many stakeholders. And so that's why I think me and my co-founder, we agree on this. We agree on this, and I think that's super important for co-founders. You know, when you're finding your counterpart, that you know, you're not butting heads. Yeah. We have healthy disagreements, but we end up coming to a happy medium and pushes it forward.
And sometimes you can drink a beer together. So
yeah, exactly. Yeah. And just hang out and just like have fun. Like that's another aspect of it too. Is like don't, you know, there's a lot to life and you know, enjoy it.
So it's great for you. It's John and Jeff then. It's J&J.
Yep.
J&J.
Yeah, so. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, we're the new J&J.
The next J&J. The next J&J.
Yeah, exactly.
So you found your co-founder. It's a long-term friend. You respect him. He respects you. You start working together and then he kicks you in the butt and say you need to go selling. And I mean, the perfect sale is always the easygoing. You go to a lab. I can also imagine in your life, you go to a customer. He immediately loves what you do. He loves your service. He loves what you have to offer and say, let me sign and let me triple the price. I like you so much. It's perfect. But my experience, 90% of the sales encounters are not going that way. There's a lot of rejection in it. What's your secret to deal with rejection?
Mission is to serve the scientific community and improve health outcomes for all. Mm-hmm. And if I give up now, we're not going to be able to achieve that mission. And we're not going to be able to get the equipment in the hands of these researchers who are making, you know, conducting life-changing research, right? So there's the element of having a mission that you truly believe in, which makes the rejection worthwhile. And it still sucks. Like it really is not fun, and you'll get rejected and it hurts, but you know, it is all worth it in the end as you're striving to achieve your goal.
That's a good statement. So having a sound mission, so a North Star that you can look towards when selling hurts.
Oh yeah. And you know, everyone's mission is going to be different. But it's finding what's right for you and your team and your org. And this is right for us. And everyone else has, you know, a different mission. But being able to rally behind it, I think, is really important because it makes it makes it not even just rejection, but just when things go up, things go down. And when things go down, things get rough, and you want, you know, if you still want to be around, you need to grit it out. And it makes it a little bit easier knowing that it's all going to be worth it.
How do you define selling? What is the definition at your company?
Yeah. So selling for us, really, it's more like education. Mm. It's the, and, you know, this took a lot of time to figure out how to communicate this. As you know, leasing and finance is kind of like a more foreign concept for scientific laboratories. So it's education and like problem solving, and like raising awareness, right? You know, I knew there was a problem because I experienced that exact problem. So I knew it was there. Like, so it's first like raising awareness, mm-hmm. like, hey, like, you know, we were in your shoes. We know these are kind of the hangups of, you know, the status quo is to always buy equipment. And I know that really can really hurt the budget. And so identifying and bringing awareness to the problem, and then educating them, like there is a solution to this. So there's an education element to that. And then obviously the one aspect that's different is like every lab is unique. And then if at that point it's like customizing the solution to fit their needs, because not one solution fits everybody. So it's like awareness, education, and then kind of like customization based on the unique circumstances of the end user. And when you combine those things and you communicate it well, it tends to work out in sales. And but you have to, like, again, you're not going to get it right on the first stop, the first try. You have to like continue to iterate. And because, you know, you'll try it once, they're going to hang up the phone. You got to try again and then see if you can improve the next go around. And yeah, it takes a long time to get that muscle. But once you do, you know, there's no better feeling than when you're on the phone with someone and you just see that it clicks.
So when people fail in business, I mean, mostly they fail with selling. And my opinion is very often they just give up after the first no. So there is a person, they meet this person or call this person or write an email and get the rejection back and then say, okay, this is a clear no. he or she doesn't want, and I don't follow up. And then there is this other group of people that I experience very often on LinkedIn who just keep chasing and send one email after the other. How do you handle this going back to potential customers, going back to prospects, and not giving the feeling that you chase them down until they say yes?
Yeah. And, you know, you obviously want to be, you know, you want to be graceful and like, you want to be, you know, you don't want to be an utter like annoyance, right? So always try to be valuable, like provide value. Like, don't just try to take, you got to give, right? And so in my perspective, like giving, like providing value to whoever you're trying to speak to is first and foremost, like what you need to do. Whether that be, you know, on the sales side, you know, it's, you know, from our perspective, it's, you know, people find out about us at, you know, all over the place on the internet or in person. And, you know, especially on the internet, it's easy to just like, you know, click send, just like annoy people. It's very like low effort, but we try our best to actually provide something of value to whoever we're reaching out to for their unique circumstances. We try to do as much research as we can on the specific, you know, potential lab that we want to work with and see if we can provide value to them, customized to them. And sometimes it doesn't work out, and that's okay. But if you're doing sales, you need to put in the work to provide value to whoever you're reaching out to, real value. Not just like, don't just go through the motions. You got to actually provide value, whatever that may be. And that to be defined by your organization. But as long as you provide value, and, you know, sometimes I get it too on mine. And sometimes I'll open a DM and I was like, oh, that was incredibly valuable. Yes, I'll have a phone call with you. Mm-hmm. But if it's something that's like, hey, I'm just following up. Hey, I'm just following up. Hey, I'm just following up. That's not valuable. Like, you know, it's just, you're just following up. You're just adding to the tons of notification red dot on my phone. That's not valuable.
It's 2 weeks since our last communication. Here is my follow-up mail.
Yeah. It's like, okay, great. Thank you, I guess. So it always be valuable, whatever that, and you have to define that for yourself and you have to define that for your org and do the work and do the research. And find creative ways to provide value. And then that will reduce the likelihood of rejection.
I mean,
in our experience.
As you said, selling is an art and a science by itself. But how do you define for you the fine line when you say, I stop here? I don't pursue the prospect further, because you said providing value. I mean, and it's one principle, and the other principle you mentioned is win-win. So providing value sometimes can end up in a situation where people just take and say, okay, of course you can lease us equipment to us, but we don't want to pay. And of course it would be some sort of value that you provide the equipment, that you say you don't have to pay. So we have it right here as a customer. How do you define the line when you say, okay, no, I stop here because it's too much coming from my side and I'm being ripped off?
Yeah. And that, you know, for leasing, you know, generally speaking, there's like a hard number. Like, you know, like if a piece of equipment is $100,000, we need to make more than $100,000 during the duration of the lease at a minimum. Like, you know, it can't be $90,000. Like, okay, well, we just gave it to you at a discount and also gave you 5 years of financing, right?
But it would be value and a win for the customer.
So. Yeah. And then for us, you know, we're just hemorrhaging cash and then maybe we can't keep the lights on, right? Because again, we don't have outside investment. You know, the money that customers pay us go towards keeping the lights on, paying for the internet, these kinds of things, right? And so I think when it comes to these like win-win scenarios and just being stakeholder focused, it's, and I don't have a hard number, but it's like you want both people and parties to feel like they came out with a good deal, but not a steal, right? One person can't feel like they got a steal because that means that the other side, they've taken a loss, right? So the win-win is where it's like, oh, this is good. I'm not like ecstatic about it. Like where, oh, like I got 90% of the pot and you got 10, right? It's there's somewhere in, it's like, that's where it's kind of like an art. It's like somewhere in the middle where both of you come out happy, but not necessarily ecstatic. And this builds for long-term relationships where you would come back. You're like, yeah, I would definitely do that again. Because business is a long game and it's a relationship game. And you can profit maximize if you want and extract as much value from the transaction. But that's very, in my opinion, very short-sighted because they won't want to work with you the next time. And it's very, and knowing that if you're, you know, for us, our horizon for Exceder is like, I want Exceder to live beyond me. I want this to be a generational company, you know, 100+ years. And extracting value and burning a customer, burning a vendor is not a way to build for that 100-year journey for Exceder. So we're very focused on building for the long term and finding that win-win where someone wants to do repeat business with us and doesn't feel like it's like they got the pie was 90% Exceder, 10% them, or vice versa. Like, you know, sometimes this happens to us and, you know, where, you know, there's kind of a win-loss scenario and it doesn't sit well. And, you know, but yeah, yes, it profit maximizes in the short term, but it jeopardizes the relationship in the long term.
Yeah, business is interesting because there's so many different people on the market. I mean, when I just think about this is one scenario, win-win. Then I always call it the Russian way. There are people on the market who simply don't care. So it's just about them. They love winning and they don't care about other people losing. And then you have also the opposite side that there are some people on the market who will always be in the losing position because they don't care about winning. So when you bring these three parties together, you have interesting combinations. I mean, the win-win people always get along well together. When you put a win-win person or a person with a win-win mindset together with a win-loss mindset, it can be very interesting. It can be very abusive when you put a person with a loss mindset together with a win-loss person. How do you deal in your company and with when you look at your supplier and customer side with these different mindsets on the market? So win-loss and loss-loss mindsets.
Yeah. So from our perspective, and this is, again, I'll speak for Exceder, but I won't speak for other businesses. I don't think there's one right way to do business. Like, there's a million ways to make $1 million. And we choose to make our living this way. Mm-hmm. It's, you know, everyone has a finite time on earth, you know, and we want to live our life this way. And if someone else wants to live their life that way and conduct business that way, I won't stop them, mm-hmm. right? It is your prerogative. But from our perspective, a worth life living is finding the win-win situations. And it's more fun that way. In our opinion, it's fun. Like, it's fun to find a win-win. And I just don't want to do business, you know, if I'm on my deathbed and just thinking about all the losers in the wake of destruction that I've left. That for me personally, it depresses me. So, but again, I'm not making a judgment call on anyone, because like some people have their own scorecards and measure success differently. But for us, and perhaps for Exceder, that doesn't mean there's like, you know, we're not going to be the biggest, you know, we're not the next Amazon or Google, right? You don't get that big unless you step on some heads and create some losers. Right. So, and that's okay for us. Like, we're not looking for world domination. We're not, you know, all we're looking for is to serve the scientific community the best we can.
That's it.
The best we can. Whatever size of company that is, I don't know. But as long as we're serving the scientific community the best we can, that makes everyone at Exceder happy. And I think sets us up for long-term success and longevity.
I like this attitude, but it also means then that sometimes you can't do business with people who have a different mindset. So sometimes it's just not a good fit. Is that the right understanding?
And we turn business away because it's not a good fit. And that's okay. Like, I think that's one aspect of sales that I had to learn the hard way. In the very beginning, I try to say yes to everything because, you know, getting your first customer is so critically important. Right? Mm-hmm. But I learned the hard way. That's going to be a long 5 years. Mm-hmm. You have to work with this. There's a contractual obligation to work with this person for 5 years. Mm-hmm. And I learned the hard way. I got, you know, a lot of anxiety, sleepless nights, you know, just, it wasn't, we let people down with grace. We say like, we don't think it's a good fit here, but, and we'll make suggestions. Like we'll try and find a solution that might be a better fit for them if it's not Exceder. Mm-hmm. And that's totally okay, in our opinion. Like, we're a right solution for a specific subset of people. And there's another, if it's not a fit with us, we're going to do our best to help you find a solution that's a good fit for you.
How is that for you? I mean, you say you want to serve the lab community. You want to serve scientists and want to help them solve their problems.
Yep.
And sometimes you have to say no. How is that for you?
People are looking for win-wins as well. You know, and I'll rib my co-founder Jeff, you know, who comes from a finance background. Sometimes finance is known to have win, like Wall Street is known for win-loss. And that makes sense, because like, if you're making trades on the public exchange, you're the act of making the trade is basically a win-loss scenario. Someone on the other side has to be willing to sell to you at a lower amount so you can, you know, so it's right. There's an imbalance, right? Mm-hmm. Someone's selling low, buying high. Someone's buying low, selling high, right? So, you know, Wall Street tends to foster that kind of mentality. And I'm not saying everyone in Wall Street's that way, but it's the mechanics of the industry that tends to form the zeitgeist. Whereas with science, it's like, okay, how do we cure cancer? It's like, oh, cancer is very complex and hard. I need to loop in like my X-ray crystallographer, my comp bio person, you know, just like literally just bring in like as many people from different disciplines as much as possible. Let's try and figure this out. Like, how are we going to finance this thing? Oh, we need the capital markets to participate. We need legal to participate, mm-hmm. intellectual property. Everybody comes together trying to solve this one hard, super hard problem, right? And so the zeitgeist of life sciences tends to be communal in that sense. So when we, you know, knock on wood, when we do sales, more often than not, it's a fit. But sometimes there isn't, and that's okay. And we try to let them down with grace and try to offer an alternative that would be a better fit.
That's a good attitude. They always smile when Americans use German words like Zeitgeist.
So it's... Yeah. Pronounce it the right way.
No, absolutely. It's great to hear sometimes German words in our conversation. Yeah. You are now, I hope you calculated it right, 2011 started your company. Mm-hmm. Now we have 2023 and I don't think the next will open. So it's 12 years. Yes, 12 yeah. years.
Yeah.
And then you decided to start a podcast.
Yeah.
I mean, you have a well-running business. And how do you see that your podcast supports your business, or is this a completely separate entity from your company?
So the Biotech Startups podcast was, you know, really the goal of it is to educate the next generation of scientific entrepreneurs and also educate those that are already on that journey. And honestly, it's just something that I wish I had when I was starting. So I could basically have a kind of a entrepreneur starter kit. So I wouldn't have to hit my head on the wall. As much trying to figure out things that, you know, could have been solved much quicker. So it's trying to accelerate that, right? Because I know coming out of the lab, you know, when you're in the lab in academia, you are heads down research. You don't, on your free time, I'm going to guess you don't know what HR is. You didn't learn about fundraising. You didn't learn about, you know, lab ops. Well, perhaps lab ops, actually, because you're running your lab. Perhaps you didn't know about intellectual property, you know, what how sales and marketing, right? Like all of these things, you don't have time when you're in your graduate studies. So our goal was to just basically, again, scratching my own itch, or maybe my former itch. Mm-hmm. It's trying to teach as many people as we can. And kind of demystify entrepreneurship is hard and it's often a black box, and we're just trying to demystify it and also show that there are plenty of ways to build a business in your own style.
I couldn't agree more. It was just running through my mind while you were speaking. It's similar attitudes that I have with my podcast. I mean, I think back to the 80s when I said I would like to start businesses, and the environment was like your parents' environment. I mean, it was all about get a job, finish your education, get a job, and then build a house, have kids, and then sometime in the future retire. But you never leave your job. You stay in your company.
Yes.
And the first things that I found very helpful were these business games that started somewhere in the 80s with Commodore C64 was a computer famous here in Central Europe. Then came the Windows computers with better simulations. Then I started business economy, business management at the University of Graz. And there I found the Harvard business cases. And I really loved this attitude that they said, look, I mean, we are not looking for laws in economy. Some things will work in certain environments, but don't work in other environments. So what we do, this was my understanding back then and still is now about these business cases, is we identify the success criteria and describe the story, the circumstances under which circumstances they worked. And everybody can read it and can then decide, I take this part or I throw it away. It doesn't work in my environment, but it's not like a law. And they always thought it would be nice to put this attitude, define business cases, to the next level. And I think podcasting, video podcasts are this next level. So we can now engage, I can now engage with people like you. You run your company in Silicon Valley or in San Francisco in the Bay Area. I'm here in Austria and I can ask you questions about your business and I can share what you say with my community and online and everybody who says, okay, what to know how his business works, what he thinks about selling, what he thinks about the life science industry and investing, listen to the podcast and then decide whether to use it in his or her environment or not.
Yeah. And I think that your perspective, it completely resonates with me. Sometimes I get like jaded when I hear, you know, what we were like earlier, we're talking about like new, like a podcast that comes up in the feed. And like, I kind of like skip through a little bit and just hear it. And sometimes people they're like, this is the one way to do it. It's the only way to do it. And I'm like, I don't know if I agree with that. And I think it's a kind of a choose your own adventure. Again, you know, it's a lifestyle, like business also is like lifestyle choices, right? Like, and everyone has different preferences, and you need to, you know, you build your business and you build your career around your own lifestyle choices and circumstances. And so, yeah, it's very much just like the Biotech Stars podcast is very much an exercise of just like bringing as much educative content out there and for letting anyone who's contemplating or on the journey decide what is the best for them. And then incorporate it. And if something doesn't resonate with you, ignore it. Like, it's okay. Like, you know, if it doesn't work for you, no problem. But at least if you could find something, at least one thing that's valuable, then I think that's in our mind a success. Because again, it all gets back to that North Star. We're trying to improve health outcomes for all. And so the more success we see in the lab, the closer we get to that goal. And that's kind of the impetus and the kind of the motivation behind the podcast.
I had such a fantastic time that we live in today. I'm now close to 50. And when I think back at the early 90s, whenever I thought this would be an interesting person to talk to, and this person happened to be somewhere in the United States, it meant traveling there. So having a phone call was expensive or difficult back then. When I wanted to talk with a teacher somewhere in the world, it meant at the university, it meant studying there. So leaving their own country, going there. And now everything is accessible online on the internet.
Yeah. It's a beautiful thing. And you know what, in a world, we have these headphones that aren't connected to your phone anymore. and you can, you know, have these conversations and you can do it on, you know, I'm obviously in my, you know, indoors right now, but I could potentially be doing this on a walk outside if I wanted to, which is like, what a time. And I think, you know, I'm excited for, you know, those who are just starting the entrepreneurial journey, because there's so much out there to learn and so much out there. Like, if you want to become an expert on something, you can become an expert. It's there at your fingertips. So it gets me really excited.
Yeah, people just have to do it.
You need someone like my co-founder kick you in the butt, like to figure it out.
This would be a nice idea for the next company. So get people going.
Yeah, exactly.
when we look at the ecosystem in your area, how is it for startups these days?
So I think the macroeconomic situation you know, it's 2022 was a very brutal year. But I do also, you know, if you look back, like historically, it's like the life sciences has always been a boom bust kind of like cyclical, like in terms of like for the early, you know, kind of early cutting edge, kind of like pushing the, like the frontier research. It's always been kind of like capital markets come and go. Now, currently, the capital markets are still open for sure. It's just like the mentality of like, you know, the go-go of like when kind of like the right after the pen, like COVID kind of like, you know, first off the pandemic, like everyone thought everything was going to disappear. And then the markets just started ripping like afterwards. And going from that to now, I think the excess is starting to kind of burn off, but there's still great research being funded. And I think it is important for those who are embarking on that journey to, you know, thinking about capital efficiency is very important. And like, you know, having kind of a little bit of a bootstrap mentality goes a long way. And you can still be a venture-backed company, but also have some bootstrap mentality in your operations, right? Like, don't burn the candle at both ends. maybe plan for a rainy day. Maybe have, you know, things like, you know, it feel, you know, now, you know, it, you know, when you are like, when I was just starting, you know, the concept of like making a 24-month projection and updating your projection of like the roadmap of your company, I know it sounds like, you know, a lot of work, but it's important. And it's kind of like the discipline of these things. It's like scoping out your headcount, scoping out like the roadmap of your research, scoping out the finances, and just like having this discipline and trying to and holding yourself to it and conveying that to investors is, you know, that will unlock funding opportunities for you. And obviously the research has to be sound, like your research has to be sound and the science has to be sound, but there's an emphasis for sure on being efficient and minimizing waste, which I think is healthy. I think it's very healthy. And so that's what I would say. It's not just contained to Silicon Valley. I'd say, you know, because the life sciences is heavily venture backed, they're still there. It's just like there's an emphasis on efficiency. And the IPO markets, you know, who knows when those will open up again, but the M&A markets are kind of heating up. So, you know, in terms of, you know, potential exits, perhaps it's not an IPO within the next 12, 18 months. Who knows? I would have to be a fortune teller to know when it opens back up. But we're definitely seeing a lot of M&A activity. That's for sure. So it's a different world, but and you know, I think the excess is kind of burnt off, you know, and now the mentality needs to change a little bit, but there's definitely funding opportunities for great teams, great founders, great science.
Did you see, I mean, in your numbers, in the numbers of a company, did you see a difference between 2022 and 2023 and 2021 in your discussions with your potential customers in your sales process, that there was a pullback from buying new equipment due to funding constraints?
Yeah. So interestingly, when things were kind of crazy go-go, and I don't want to get overly financy, but the concept of cost of capital was non-existent, right? And the cost of capital, just if I were to like distill it down, equity, raising venture capital is far more expensive than credit, which is what a lease is, right? A lease is like a fixed monthly payment. And yes, it's going to be, you know, a little bit more than a dollar. Like if you have a dollar of credit, you're going to have to pay back a little bit more than a dollar. Whereas when you give up equity, you're giving up the infinite upside of your company. And that concept, in the go-go days, no one really took it seriously because you can, you know, then someone's going to be banging on your door trying to fund you, right? With equity, right? And this is what I mean is a little bit healthy. Like there's like people are now realizing this is not a novel concept. This is basic finance. And so what we've seen is that with this emphasis on efficiency and optimizing your weighted average cost of capital, it hasn't stopped the need for equipment. The research needs to get done, right? Like I said, like the FDA is the FDA, their deadline is their deadline. You're going to have to hit that deadline one way or another. And so people are now exploring alternative ways to get their infrastructure needs met, particularly equipment. There's also the real estate aspect where people are like, maybe we can downsize the space. We can utilize some shared space versus just having a monster lease on a big building. So people are looking for alternative ways to be more efficient in how they allocate their capital and time. And so we've actually seen folks who maybe in the go-go would have just opted to buy with equity are now seeing the value of not having to allocate, you know, a couple million bucks of their seed round for equipment and rather finance it. So that's what we've seen is the mentality shift.
So it's basically good for your business then.
Yeah, it's been busy. That's for sure. I thought I was crazy when people are like, we've had so many conversations with people who are just like, yeah, we'll just buy it with equity. And we're just like, whoa, like the math, like, I don't know how this math pencils out, but your decision is your decision. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately there's been a lot of conversations where, you know, folks have kind of like buyer's regret. Like they had just bought a lot of equipment before the market's kind of dried up. It's not fully dried up, but it's kind of slowed down. And now they have all this, they've spent, you know, nowadays like seed rounds are like, you know, 5 to 10 million, mm-hmm. somewhere around there. You know, they've spent like half of their seed round on equipment. And they're like, we can't hire anymore because all that cash just went into the equipment. Whereas, you know, now they're, we've been able to help them with sale leasebacks where we purchase the equipment from them and then lease it back. Mm. So basically they get that, you know, they get a lease. In effect, it's just like you are able to lease the equipment you recently bought. But what ends up happening now is like people are now the awareness and understanding of this and the importance of this, where if you're getting a $5 million seed check and there's two, the success of your lab is, I'm oversimplifying here, is contingent on having a killer team and having the tools, the equipment for your team to use. Mm-hmm. One without the other, is you're kind of like you're running a race with one leg, right? If you just have the equipment but no one to use the equipment, mm-hmm. you're not going anywhere. If you have people but no tools, you're still going really slowly. So leasing enables you to get the equipment without breaking the bank, which then allows you to hire the people to get your research done. And then if you're a venture-backed startup, this is music to the venture capitalist's ears, right? Because now they're like, okay, great. The likelihood of you reaching your milestone 12 months from now you can hit it in 6 or 3 or whatever it may be. And then that gets you to your next funding round. Like it kind of gets you to that next inflection point. And so that concept is, I think, becoming more prevalent. And this is, you know, I think we're starting to see the kind of the sea change.
I mean, equipment leasing is a great tool, in my opinion, for the reasons you described. You can allocate more capital to build your team, so you get more hands working and still have the equipment. But there is one problem in, especially for example, therapeutics drug development. Usually, the funding rounds don't last forever. So they last for a couple of years, 2 or 3 years, and then the companies need to raise further funds. And there is no guarantee that the company successful in raising funds. Yeah. A lot can happen. We can get a pandemic, war can start, especially here in Europe. And the entire investment scene or community is turned over and people don't want to invest anymore. Lease contracts, especially for expensive equipments, don't make any sense when it's over 1 year or 2 years. So usually when I run a company, I would like to lease it for a longer period so that they have smaller installments at the beginning and not the whole payout in 1 year, because then I can buy it myself. It's no failure. I want to stretch out the capital. The risk for you then, for a company like yours, is that I can't successfully close the next round and they can't pay you anymore. How do you manage that risk that your customers don't exist anymore and you get the equipment back and probably can't use some machines? They are sometimes customized for special purposes. You can't resell it. How do you manage that risk?
Yeah, so this gets back to kind of our what makes Exceder special. Right? Mm-hmm. It's we only work with labs. We only work with lab equipment, mm-hmm. and we only work within the life sciences. Mm-hmm. Our expertise in that enables us to underwrite the risk. Mm-hmm. What feels like equity risk, we can better underwrite it because we understand it. Mm-hmm. Like we truly understand it. We, you know, when we evaluate a company, like, you know, I use JP Morgan as an example, but some large institution, they're not going into the science. Mm-hmm. They're like, send me three years of profits. Okay. Did you have enough profits?
You don't have that usually in a drug development company.
Exactly. So, you know, like, show me 3 years of profits.
Yeah.
You don't have that? Next applicant, right? For us, we're going in there holistically, right? Mm-hmm. We know the operations, we know the financials, we know in the industry, we know the equipment. So we are able to, and that's what we were talking about sales earlier, is like customizing, right? We customize the lease to fit up. It has to be appropriate for your labs, for your specific lab. You know, for example, an R&D therapeutic company is very different than a contract research org, right? Who has cash flows. Sometimes there are therapeutics companies that also do contract research. Sometimes they have royalties from their from licensing. Mm-hmm. They have collaboration, they have partnership. There's all these elements of a life science company. It comes in a bunch of different flavors. And we're able to evaluate that because this is our world, right? And, you know, we all the time, people are like, will you do a tractor or an RV lease? We have to say no to that. That's not a good fit. Yeah. we're not tractor or RV experts. And that's okay, right? And that's okay. We're the life science people. And, you know, and we work with folks in climate and renewables as well. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and also like the kind of, you know, kind of like, I guess the bio ag and like all the new kind of like, you know, industrial applications. Anyways, that what you were describing is our job to, again, find a win-win. Mm-hmm. We are taking risk. There is no, you know, it's a risk reward. We are taking risk. We understand that. But it's kind of like poker. We're sizing up what is appropriate. We're not going all in on every single, right? If you're going to lose your poker game if you just go all in every time a hand gets dealt, right? Yeah. You're going to lose. So it's our job to evaluate the applicant holistically. Mm. And, you know, we've been doing this for so long. We have a very, very equipment. and that's the name of the game. You know, if the lease can't be fulfilled, we have to pick up the equipment. Mm. And that's part of the risk that we underwrite, right? Mm. So hopefully, we knock on wood, we want to see them successful. So we're going to do everything in our power to help them get to that next funding round. Put them in touch with the right people. You know, if we can put them in touch with an investor, we're going to do so. And that's part of the benefit of being in this ecosystem is that we also know the venture capitalists too. so we can connect the dots. If some, and you know, if someone is, you know, if we can help and lend a hand, we're going to do it. Mm-hmm.
That's cool. But it don't take equity at the end of the day. So at the end of the day, it must be a win-win. So it must be a foreseeable win-win. And sometimes had the also some parties here in Europe who say, okay, I mean, give me equity in case you come back.
Yeah, some folks do that. So we don't ask for equity. That's for the founders and the original set of investors. That's for them. Here's the lease payment.
Yeah.
We want a lease that will help you help us. And we're not trying to, you know, we're not trying to complicate things by asking for equity in your company. You guys are the experts here on running your lab. So, that ought to be yours.
When you look at your customer side, what's your biggest success story? So, when we look at, for example, startups, how did your company help them become successful?
Yeah. So as actually, close friend of mine, Jake Glanville, close friend and colleague. He was the first guest on the Biotech Startups podcast. He's the first episode, first guest. I love talking about him and his company. So Distributed Bio was his original company. And we basically helped them from the super early days, like probably like sub 5 employees. Mm-hmm. It was them in an incubator space, getting them with the equipment they need at that phase. And that helped them, you know, as they kind of took over more and more bench space at the lab space, you know, we helped them get the equipment. And then they finally outgrew that and they got their own floor. They were a very interesting company. They were both a R&D and contract research org. So we were helping them, you know, on all fronts. And with the more equipment that they were able to get, they were able to do more R&D and also do more contract research. So it brought in more service revenue. And that helped them get to those next inflection points. You know, I remember when they got their second floor and then we helped them with the equipment there. And then they ultimately sold to Charles River. So that journey was like, you know, it was a small team on a shared bench all the way to acquisition. And we continue to work. And then Jake also now runs Centivax, which was the spin out of that of Distributed Bio. And we continue to work with him to this day. And I think the kind of our ability to work at the state, even at the stage of like when someone's just sharing a lab bench, all the way up to whether it's an IPO or it's an acquisition, is that we take great pride in. And also, we're not going to we're going to also tell you if a lease is not right at that time, right? Like if you're leasing too much, it could also become a burden. So we will also tell you that, right? Like we want to win-win. So we want to do what's right for you and what's right for us. And we want to help you get there. Whether it's, you know, a handful of people, you know, all the way up to like 50 people or more, you know? So that Distributed Bio is I love to talk about them. Really, really cool story. They were in the Netflix movie, Pandemic. They were a kind of a star of that series. So take a look at them if you guys have a chance.
What is the name of the series? Pandemic?
Pandemic.
Pandemic,
on Netflix.
I thought not the real pandemic. So it's the series.
Well, so they Distributed Bio, they do a lot of vaccine R&D. So it was like right in their wheelhouse when everything was kind of going crazy.
I believe that. Yeah. So your role, I think, when I look at investing in companies, therapeutics, labs, they have basically two cost positions. One is then leasing, if this are your customers, and HR. So there is not much more except studies, of course. So you must be then a major position in the profit and loss statement. And I can imagine that sometimes probably one or the other investor would like to speak with you when they do their due diligence. So you must be exposed basically to the entire investment landscape in Silicon Valley with your work.
Yeah, we talk to investors a lot. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think we get a lot of temperature checks with them and kind of see where they're at. And they're actively deploying, that's for mm-hmm. sure. And I think venture has a right place and a right time for an equity infusion. Leasing is a right place and a right time. And it's finding the right combination mm-hmm. Of the two. Mm-hmm. It's equity financing and credit. You don't want to be over leveraged and have too many leases. You know, that's also a problem. But you also don't want to be like too heavily equity financed, where that's the risk of dilution. So mm-hmm. it's finding that balance. And we collaborate all the time with them.
Mm. How do you see? I mean, we had the glorious days until up to 2022, where capital was basically available for free. Abundance, everybody got financed. And I think in every incubation program in Europe and probably also in the United States, the first lesson founders got was not find your customer, it was find your investor. Yep. And then it changed last year with, especially here in Europe, it's attributed to the war in Ukraine. How do you see the development of availability of venture capital in Silicon Valley in the next 10 years?
Yeah, so it's hard to call it and make a prediction with any mm-hmm. sort of like concreteness, but I always come back to the science being as exciting as has ever been. There's a lot of new modalities that are available, like to solve really pressing healthcare issues, mm-hmm. and there's a lot of smart people too working on these problems. And I think healthcare and life sciences is of growing importance. People ultimately want to live longer, healthier lives and more fulfilling lives. And so I think the equity financing and venture capital ecosystem, they realize this and will continue to fund good founders, good research. And the research is great right now. And there's a great amount of like founders that are coming out of, whether it's big pharma, academic institutions, you name it. And that combination of a, secular trend where, people want to live healthier and good research is going to get funded it's the North Star, right? Mm-hmm. That's the North Star of our industry, is to like have people live healthier, longer lives, and the money will follow. Mm-hmm. It may not be smooth. It may be like this. And in the moment, it feels like we're never going to get out of these trenches, but it's always a boom bust. And it'll over time, it'll net out. Sorry, the camera's wrong. It'll net out, right? It'll go, go in the right direction. So that's where I see it going. Obviously, I could be a little bit biased because I am a participant in this ecosystem, but that's how I see it. And it might feel painful right now, but we've gone through cycles before, and this is a cycle. And as long as the North Star is right, I think we'll be just fine.
I think it's a natural law. It's always up and down, as I say, boom and bust. Yep. So there was this 87 was a huge crisis. Then the dot-com bubble burst in 2000. I think Amazon was down 90%.
Yeah.
Back then, who would have guessed? Apple was close to extinction in the 90s.
Yeah.
Then we had 2007 and 8. We had 2012 and then a whole lot of minor crises. And it always is up and down, up and down.
Yep, exactly. And I think just not getting overly fixated on like the next 3 months, even the next 12 months, try to think even longer and ask yourself from like first principles, like, what are the dynamics of this? And I think you'll probably come to the same conclusion that, mm-hmm. you know, it's worthwhile being optimistic about life sciences and healthcare.
I mean, I come to one conclusion when I look at Europe. We still have the same problem like 17 years ago. It's very, mm-hmm. Europe is a great place for science. There is a lot of public funding on the market, and I think this makes Europe unique. It's very attractive for basic researchers to come to Europe, tap into the public funding pots. When I look at seed rounds, they're a little bit smaller than in the United States still, but there is enough capital on the market to get companies off the ground.
Yep.
But Series A, Series B, Series C, IPOs, we have the problem here in Europe that there is not enough capital. That's why the best companies from Europe always look towards the United States. I think CRISPR Therapeutics, for example, gene editing, okay. With Emmanuel Charpentier and Rodger Novak running the company or started the company a couple of years ago, Boston. Other companies relocated from Europe to the San Francisco area. What's your advice for European companies when they say, okay, I mean, we don't find funding here. We have great tech. We have the world's best tech. We have the best team. Everybody's willing to relocate to San Francisco. What's your advice besides you are there for leasing and you can
give
the equipment? What's your advice in navigating the investment landscape?
Yeah. So I would say there's a couple aspects. I think the United States is having a somewhat of like a Cambrian explosion of, you know, it's not just San Francisco anymore, mm-hmm. or the Bay Area, and it's not just Boston anymore. You know, Seattle, San Diego, Philadelphia, New York, North Carolina, you know, the list goes on and on and on. And obviously, you know, this tends to cluster around research universities. There are plenty of places. Again, this gets back to capital efficiency and just like weighing those out. So there are plenty of areas that where you have great pools of talent, a bunch of real estate options, and also proximity to investors and industry peers, which are, I would say, a key criteria. Like you need to be able to access those things those are the ingredients for success. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't, I don't think it's necessarily just exclusive to Silicon Valley. So a recommendation is to look into other areas that are up and coming. And that will enable you to, and a lot of those areas are investing, like this actual governments are investing in infrastructure and resources for those that are starting life science companies or, you know, setting down roots. And so, you know, for example, New York's not cheap, but they are building a ton of lab space. Mm-hmm. And, you know, South San Francisco is always, you know, is always building lab space, but, you know, they've been building lab space since Genentech just got started in the 80s. So it's very developed. And basically making these key considerations, where the pool of talent, the real estate options, and proximity to investors and industry peers. Mm-hmm. And you can just do like, this is like the research that you can do is like, you can Google this. You don't need to hire McKinsey to do this research for you. You can Google this and take a look at that. And you'll see that you might be able to get a very high standard, a high level for a much lower cost, right? And again, it's right now raising investments is all about efficiency. Like also good founders, good science, but also there's an element of being efficient, right? Mm. So being in San Francisco, which is very, very expensive, may not be the right solution. But of course, we have very rich talent, industry peers and investors, but that's also elsewhere too. So that's what I would say, open the aperture. Like be open to the idea of not necessarily having to be in Silicon Valley and, you know, looking in these other hotbeds.
Rushing a long-term dream of many people to relocate to San Francisco and the Bay Area. Yeah. But it's true. I think last year I had Jane Carraway from Georgia on the podcast, and I met her at the Bio in San Diego. And for me, it was always, the United States was always Boston and San Francisco. So these are these two big hubs where you can relocate. And she started telling the same story like you did. No, there are more spots now in the United States. And I said, why are we not aware of that here in Europe? When I ask our development organizations, they always recommend Boston and San Francisco. And it seems there's a lot going on in the States.
Yeah. Yeah. It's, I think Boston and Silicon Valley and San Francisco just are able to live, you know, in the minds of like, it's also very, it's in the headlines. But there are plenty of opportunities elsewhere. Which should not, I think it's often goes overlooked, but are great opportunities.
Would you be open that people contact you? I mean, you have a great overview about the ecosystems in the United States. When they are really serious about relocating and consider working together with you, would you be open that they contact you also for questions, which ecosystem would be the best fit for the pool of talents they're looking for, the lab space in combination with availability of funding?
Yeah, absolutely.
Cool.
Yeah, people can definitely reach out. And my team is also really, really knowledgeable about it as well. We have, you know, Exceder has folks on the West Coast and East Coast and all over the place. So we actually have like boots in the ground in those areas too. So more than happy to chat.
It's fun talking to you, but I had just a look at the time and I think we are almost at 2 hours. So
yeah.
Time flies when you have fun. I have to jump to the final questions. What's your long-term vision for your company? Where do you see your company in the next 10 years?
Yeah. So, you know, honestly, it almost sounds like the next 10 years, I even want to extend it like, just like, I touched on this like earlier. Like I want Exceder to be a generational company. And in the next 10 years, we're doing everything that we can to further that effort. So it's better serving scientists, getting them the equipment they need, and getting them basically to accelerate their research and hit their milestones and commercialization efforts faster. And I think we haven't talked about it publicly yet, but we're finding ways to further improve our leases and provide more value to our clientele with exclusive, you know, kind of exclusive perks. So, you know, we're continuing to find, again, it's about growing the pie. And so we're trying to find ways to continue to expand that pie and provide more value to our clientele. So in the next 10 years, I guess it doesn't sound overly grandiose, but it's just like doing more of what we currently do and doing it better. And perhaps there's an expansion into another country in the next 10 years, but we'll see.
Conquer Europe.
Yeah. Not conquer. We'll dip our toes and just like kind of see figure it out.
Yeah. We have 3 minutes left. Is there any point that you would like to address on this podcast and that I didn't ask questions about?
No. Honestly, I think we've covered a lot of like fantastic topics. I guess the one just kind of reminder I want to leave with people is just like, it takes a village to this. Science is hard. Like science is super hard and it takes a village and it takes a team. I'm very grateful for those that have supported Exceder along the way. My wife, I couldn't have done it without her. My co-founder, Jeff, the amazing Exceder team. And also I was going to give a shout out to an organization that I'm really, really excited about, Nucleate. So Nucleate is I compare them to basically the Y Combinator for the life sciences and the sciences. They're a student run organization. That's a nonprofit that is fostering scientific entrepreneurship. And they're basically teaching PhDs and MBAs and pairing them. And basically they are helping them with company formation. They're helping them with entrepreneurship, teaching them the ins and outs, how to pitch, how to fundraise, you know, running a company, you name it. And they're helping the next generation of folks who are trying to translate science out of academia into, the private sector. And we love them. They're a fantastic organization. really, really love their mission. And so, you know, just want to give them a shout out too. Because I think they're going to play a big role in the future of biotech and the life sciences.
What's the website of the organization?
Nucleate.xyz. I'll actually drop this in chat.
.xyz. XYZ. It's the first time I see this. Here we have it. Let's just flash it.
And they're in Europe as well.
Oh, really?
Yep.
So, it's this one.
Yep.
We empower biotech leaders. It's the Y Combinator of the life science industry. I didn't know them.
And they don't take equity. It's just to foster entrepreneurship.
Atlas Venture, MassBio, 5AM Ventures, Harvard University, Stanford. World-class advisors. It's really great. Thanks for pointing that out. And this seems to be the locations. So where are they in Europe?
I think there you go.
I'm curious. Sorry for that.
Yeah, no worries. I know they're in Germany, Switzerland, the UK. They have locations.
It's great. I have to look it up.
And it continues to expand as well.
Okay.
Definitely recommend people checking them out.
So they don't take equity, and their model is basically to support companies in their formation.
Yep.
And hook them up with VCs, train them. Mm-hmm. And similar to Y Combinator.
Yep. But without the equity.
But how can they survive then? I mean,
it's a nonprofit. So it's a nonprofit. And, you know, donations, you know, sponsorships and stuff like that. So they're very much aligned with, you know, the folks that go through their program. We love them. They're great. And, you know, all the people who go through their program are a blast to work with. And we love working with the Nucleate team.
Thanks for the shout out at the end. I know whom I contact for the next episode. Ask them to come online. It would be a great thing to have them. John, 2 hours. It's so fast. It's fantastic speaking to you, listening to your stories. Congratulations to the success to you and your team, and keep inspiring and keep moving your company forward and help scientists.
Yeah, Christian, thank you for the time. I appreciate it. It was a blast. And let's do this again soon.
Super. Have a great day. Bye.
Yeah, bye.
And that wraps up our enlightening conversation with John Che. Today, we delved deep into the transformative power of innovative leasing models in the biotech world and how they are revolutionizing startups' journeys. The essence: breaking barriers, accelerating research, and reshaping the future of biotech in Silicon Valley and beyond. Thank you for tuning in and being a part of this journey with me. If this episode resonated with you, please help spread the word. Your voice matters. If you are listening on Spotify or Apple, we'd be grateful for a 5-star review. Positive comments and your feedback not only boost our spirits, but also help others discover the podcast. And remember, sharing is caring. Pass this episode along to colleagues, friends, or anyone you believe would benefit from these insights. Your support enables the team to attract industry trailblazers like John Che, ensuring we continue delivering content that empowers and enlightens the podcast community. So stay tuned for more episodes, and until next time, keep innovating and keep growing.